Eat, Drink, Indie Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat, drink, indie. Welcome to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, we've opened up the archives and found some favorite interviews from the past year. A recent announcement of a new location prompted a revisit to last fall's interview with Gwendolyn Rogers of the Cake Bake Shop, which will be opening next year in Carmel. All the changes on Indy's Massachusetts Avenue made me think of the best chocolate in town owner, Elizabeth Garber, who's been on Mass Ave more than 10 years now. So we'll check out an interview from last winter with Elizabeth as well. And the city's first cat cafe was one of my favorites from this past year, too. So we'll listen in again as Selena Hubbard and her dad, Eric, tell us about Nine Lives Cat Cafe. And I just love the backstory of Iozzo's Garden of Italy restaurant. So we'll hear from owner Katie Harris, whom we first talked to this past summer. And because the summer farmers market season is winding down, we'll check in again with Maria Smetana of the Farm to Fork Market at Normandy Farm in Indianapolis, which operates year-round. So stay with us for more here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. I love it when a local business idea succeeds. And then when success leads to expansion, well, that's even better. The Cake Bake Shop in Broad Ripple in Indianapolis is about to hit its third anniversary, and owner Gwendolyn Rogers just announced that next fall she'll open a second cake bake location, this time in Carmel. And judging by a recent Facebook post announcing the new shop, a post that garnered more than 700 comments, there are plenty of excited cake bake fans. But I love the backstory about how the shop came about. Last fall, when the Cake Bake Shop had just hit its second anniversary in Broad Ripple, I stopped in to talk with Gwendolyn about how it all started and how the cake bake concept began.
2 years, long, exhausting, hard, a ton of work, I never sleep. I look like the president. I've aged 20 years in two. But at the same time, it's been an incredible journey. And I have an amazing staff of 61 people now. When I first started, I thought, how am I going to find enough people to help me? And now having 61 staff members is incredible.
You have 61 staff in this. It's a small shop.
Mm-hmm. Well, we rotate a lot. They're not all here at the exact same time. But I have 18 bakers in the kitchen. I have 3 savory chefs, and I have three general managers. I've got 2 event planners. So it's a lot, but it's really incredible.
Did you envision that scope when you started?
God, no. No, in my business plan, I had 8 people, and I thought, oh my gosh, how am I gonna make enough food to pay 8 people? So no, it's gone above and beyond my expectations.
So tell me about what it was like when you first opened. You know, we walked through the building then, and you talked about how you had remodeled a cottage here in Broad Ripple. What was it like when you first opened?
Well, when I first opened, I had a lot of people tell me that I should throw an event and tell everyone that I was opening. It was my opening day, and we'd have a grand opening party. And I didn't want to spend the money on that because I didn't have any. So all I did was turn the sign. And the minute I turned the sign, we had a line out the door, and people would wrap around the counter. And we originally started as counter service because I didn't think that it was going to be – I didn't think people were going to like it. I really didn't. I didn't know what to expect. And so we ended up getting so busy that after having counter service, people would order a piece of cake, and we couldn't find them because there were so many people in here. We didn't know where they went. So it's like, okay, now we have to give people numbers. So then we tried that, and that didn't really work because then we couldn't see the numbers because there was too many things on the tables. And so then we now we're in full swing of waiter service, and we have hostesses every day, and we have reservations online. And so we have evolved like a ton since we first opened. It just has grown into something I never expected.
So when you first opened, it was November, right? Of two years ago. And you opened, decorated for Christmas, right? And here we are again, beautifully decorated for Christmas. And it is, it's magical and gorgeous and sparkly. Tell me what the vision was for Cake Bake Shop.
Well, when I first started, my vision was just to really be like I said before, to make an extension of my home, and it would be a place where people could come in and I could be making the recipes that I've been making for over 30 years. But now I just get to share it with a wider audience. And that was originally my vision. I just wanted it to be really beautiful. I wanted it to be a place where you could come and eat a dessert and have a glass of wine or champagne and not feel like you had to sit in your car. That's how I started. When I would go to Taylor's, I would buy a little donut hole and I'd sit in my car and I'd eat them. And I'm like, I'm not a closet eater, but I don't have a place to go. And so I wanted to make a place for people to come, you know, that would have a fireplace and it would be warm and cozy and inviting, and you'd want to come and hang out with your friends.
Now, how did you make that happen? I mean, you're a busy career person. You know, you have kids, you have a family. How did you do it?
I didn't see my kids for 2 years, basically. I would leave and they would be asleep. Thank God my husband was not working at the time, so he could stay home and take care of the boys. But I literally would leave when they were sleeping, and I would come home and they would be asleep. So I would miss their entire day. But they knew where I was, so I was only maybe a mile from home. So if they wanted to see me, they could come here. But I never was home very much for the first 2 years. So it's really nice that I've hit that 2-year mark, because now I have a little bit more free time. I don't have a lot, but at least I get to take them to school now, so that's good. And I pick them up. So,
Tell me what a day is like here at the Cake Bake Shop for you.
For me? Well, I'll give you an example of today. I got here at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I'm reteaching some girls how to make pie dough, because we have Thanksgiving coming, and we have a lot of pie orders that we have to fulfill. So I came in at 5. We did like a little pie dough making course. And then I went home and I woke up my children and I drove them to school. And then I came back to the shop and we continued to make pie dough. And we made a couple of fillings for pies. And then I had a meeting come in. So I had to meet with them. And now you're here. And so then I'm going to go, and we're having a wonderful time. And I'm forcing you to eat all kinds of desserts, which I love. And then I'm going back into the kitchen to make more pies for the rest of the day. And then I'll pick up my kids later. Yeah. And I won't make dinner because I don't have time. So I'll get them Chipotle, I guess. So that's my day, basically, and it continues. So usually I don't know if it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday, because they all blend into me. Next thing I know, it's Christmas. Next thing I know, it's spring break. I'm like, wow, time flies. So
now you must be always thinking about the shop and new items and new things to make. I'm sure that that's constantly going through your head.
It's always going through my mind. We change our menu every 3 months. So every 3-month period, we will rotate all of our cake flavors for the season. I have certain cakes that I used to take off the menu, but when I would take them off, people would get really upset. So they're like, that's my favorite cake. You can't take that off the menu. So now we have 7 cakes constantly that we always have. And then I rotate 5 more cakes every couple of months. So right now we have our caramel popcorn cake. We have all of our fall items. We have our pumpkin ginger cake. So in December, on the 1st, we're going to switch it over to chocolate peppermint and all kinds of yummy holiday treats. Well, our eggnog cheesecake that we bring out. We have a beautiful coconut cake that we make for Christmas. So it's nice because it keeps it interesting and it keeps it changing so that you always want to come back. And then I always am changing the decorations. And I do that for the season also. So I'm kind of like Disney in a way that on Halloween night, I was up for 18 hours and we take down all the Halloween decorations and you wake up the next morning and all of a sudden it's Christmas here. So, and this will stay up until spring. And then I have a whole new plan of decor for spring. So yes, I'm constantly thinking about what I'm going to do next.
Now, all of the recipes and the cakes, the pies, the cookies, are these things that you created over the years, is that right?
They've been recipes that I've been making for over 30 years. And when I first started, I have a huge book full of tear sheets from magazines. I think I was one of Bon Appetit's first subscribers when they first started. And I have hundreds of recipes that I have, you know, spills on and notes. I would always change them a little bit to tweak them, how if I didn't like it at too much salt or if I thought it had too much sugar. And so those are the recipes that we're making today. Every single thing that we serve here is something that I've made in the past. Yeah.
Now, I think you told me a couple of years ago when you first opened that, you know, you had you know, taken cakes to school for so many years and given teacher presents and that sort of thing. Tell me how did that sort of developed, how you polished these recipes and cooked over the years?
Well, I started that actually because when I moved here, I was 43 and I had to start over because I didn't know anyone. I had no friends. I didn't know, you know, I figured one day I'll learn all the names of all the people that are at school. And the way for me to do that was to make food and bring it to different people's homes. And that's how I got to know people. That was kind of my way of trying to get myself to be comfortable and introduce myself. Like, hi, here I am. I have a pie. And so that's kind of how I started, at least here in Indianapolis.
Now, your husband is from here, but you weren't. Is that right?
That's correct. He grew up here, was born here and grew up here and went to Park Tudor. And we moved here to be closer to his family and to be close to his mom and his sister. And so our boys could go to the same school that he went to, give him a better education. So that's why we moved here.
Now, but it must not have been, I mean, it was probably a financial challenge to open this vision that you had. So it wasn't easy, was it?
No. God, no, absolutely not. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done, actually. Just to find a place that I thought that I could open up into was going to cost me money that I didn't have. And I knew that in the vision that I wanted to create, that I was going to have to get a loan from somewhere because my husband and I don't have a lot of money. And I went to 5 different banks to try to get loans, and they all said no. And every meeting that I went to, of course, I brought either cupcakes or I brought cakes or I brought desserts, and they would eat them. And they're like, this is delicious. Have you ever opened up a restaurant before? I said, no. Well, do you have $300,000? I was like, no. If I had that, I wouldn't be here. And they all said no. So it was really, that was the hardest challenge. That every morning I would wake up, I was like, you know what, I can't give up now because I already gave up my oldest son's college fund and I gave up my second child's college fund. I thought, I am so far in it financially that I can't turn back. And I went to one more bank, and that was First Merchants Bank, and they said yes. And if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be here.
Oh my goodness. Now what a story. So you put those savings into the business. That was a risk.
Well, it was, because my husband was either going to leave me and we were going to go bankrupt, or I was going to wake up every single day at 4 a.m. and I was going to bake something and I was going to make it work. And I did. Thank God. Thank God I made it work.
We've been talking with Cake Bake Shop owner Gwendolyn Rogers. For updates and information on the new location, look for the Cake Bake Shop on Facebook or check out thecakebakeshop.com. Massachusetts Avenue in Indianapolis is undergoing considerable change right now, with new buildings going up, others being renovated, and plans being made for new ones as well. But 10 years ago, the scene was much different. The cultural trail was just a green stripe painted on the pavement, and there weren't nearly as many businesses on Mass Ave. Certainly not at the far end, where you'll find the best chocolate in town. But chocolatier Elizabeth Garber, who had been operating her chocolate business in Franklin, Indiana, saw potential in the 800 block of Massachusetts Avenue, where the highly acclaimed Our Bistro had opened in 2001. There was momentum, and she saw what the area could be.
The best chocolate in town. You know, you've hit 10 years in your location on Mass Ave, but that's not where the story started. So tell me a little bit about how you started the business and what you were doing then.
Okay, so I started in college my senior year as a little side gig to make extra cash for the holidays. So I did that for 3 Christmases, and I had then graduated and was like, I was working in a gallery and working, doing some catering and selling to a lady in Nashville, Indiana, wholesale to her. And it started to pick up, and I thought, well, maybe I could do this full time. So I wrote up a business plan, and this was in 1998. And my parents were like, well, you might as well try it. And so I kind of went for it. Not kind of, I did. And so I opened my first space. My rent was $200 a month for about 200 square feet. Yeah. I feel really old right now, back in my day. And so it was this little in downtown Edinburgh, this little space where I, you know, made it all health department approved and just did it. And I was there for a year and then grew enough to expand. And then I moved that space to Franklin and acquired more square footage. And I was in Franklin for about 8 years, 8-ish to 9. And then in 2007, moved up to Mass Ave.
And back then, this end of Mass Ave wasn't nearly as busy as it is now.
So when I moved to the Avenue, I kind of did an analysis like, okay, I can go, I can get my foot in, find a spot, still be, I could be closed basically, have no retail sales, but still selling all this other stuff from wholesale, right? So when I started here on the Avenue then, I was still already, I had other orders we were filling, and so the walk-in traffic was a lot less. And then over time, obviously the retail side has really taken over, and I don't have as many gift, you know, 2008 with the whole economy crash, the gift basket industry just went kaput.
Well, that's interesting. I never thought about that being one of the industries affected by that, but yeah.
It was. A lot of the luxury stuff. And then with September 11th, that was a huge thing for corporate really changing their budget around. And they were, instead of big corporate parties, especially that particular year, there were no corporate, very few corporate parties, a lot of donations, less gifting. And then even after that, for a long time, for those that remember, a lot of there was not as much party scene going on. And so the corporate budgets were really cut for gifts and stuff.
So what was it like when you opened on Mass Ave? What was the feeling of the block? Because all of this construction that we're looking out the window now, it just wasn't there.
Our bistro was down on the end. There was the sidewalk with the, I think it was like a green paint line indicating where the cultural trail would go.
Where it was going to go, right?
Where it was going to go. So there was all that fun project to go through. And the building across from us now, Trailside, that was owned by Center Township, and it was just vacant and not functioning. So there wasn't nearly as much stuff around here. So I kind of got in while I could in a space that was affordable for me and let things build up around me.
And they did. So the people came. The cultural trail did come in. And now what's it like to be in business on Mass Ave?
It's great. And people are excited. And it's always busy. And there's been so much great growth all up and down the whole avenue. And some of it's just, as things shift and change, figuring out how you fit into that model and how to just sustain, doing the best that you can all the time and then making yourself relevant and fitting in, because it does things shift and change over time, and things become more interesting to people than other things, and some things feel old. And so, what do you do to stay relevant? And so this is kind of our new thing of being able to say, hey, we've still got great chocolate, because that doesn't really change. It's like, if it's good, it's good. It doesn't just get bad unless you change something. And then adding in great desserts and the espresso and having seating now, and so updating ourselves a little bit and trying to just enjoy the growth around us now. We don't have to say, over college, there's more stuff. Yeah, keep going. No, keep going. Another block. Yeah, we're down on the left.
So just tell me about how the shop has grown this past year.
Oh, okay. So this past year, we have grown by leaps and bounds. The holidays always kind of push us beyond our limits with the quantity that we can never quite achieve everything. So all the quantity that people want. So we finally hit that spot where over the past year we've changed up the space a little bit. We've grown to 3,100 square feet in another commercial kitchen. We've added the cafe seating. And really just pushed a little to achieve really things and thoughts and plans that have been in my head for quite some time.
So tell me what things that you think about. Tell me what you're going to be doing at the production facility and the baking that you're doing there, and what might be coming down the road.
So at the commercial kitchen off-site from here is where we make our cookie dough, and then we bring it over and we bake it here. So it's baked. We can bake fresh daily. We'll be making the brownies over at the other space. We have what's called the Pave Maria, which is a flourless chocolate cake that will make you sing Ave Maria. So there's that. And then we're going to have some specialty things. We're going to hopefully seasonally we'll work with like Waterman's and get strawberries for strawberry pie. And, we want to be real seasonal with some real special, unique things that will be limited. But we'll still have the pave. I've got a really great chocolate peanut butter tart that we're going to be making. We made that this summer, and I need to pull that back out and get it going. So we've got a lot of those kinds of things at that space. And most of the – it's hard to break up the production piece. Well, you boil caramel, you let it cool, then you have someone else who's cutting it and dipping it. So to have that under one roof is pretty essential. So it was a struggle to decide to move most of that, because you can't see as much. We're going to try to bring more dipping back, but you can't see as dipping. We're using the chocolate for mochas and hot chocolates and really wonderful stuff. But most of that production has to be at the other space under one roof.
So people in the past, they had seen you working over in a small area of the Mass Ave shop, mm-hmm. But even though they might not be seeing you doing as much work there, you'll have more stuff in the shop, right?
Right. We'll have more stuff in the shop, and they'll be able to see us baking, and you'll smell the cookies. And there will be times where we'll be emergency cooking on the stove in the back and making caramel. And we'll probably still be dipping some at those machines every, well, hopefully not just during the holidays. We may try to bring some dipping back here. But yeah, a lot of it's at the other space, 3 minutes away.
We've been talking with Elizabeth Garber of The Best Chocolate in Town. You can find out more about the shop at bestchocolateintown.com or look for it on Facebook. So here's a cool idea. What if you could go to a local coffee shop, order a latte, and then enjoy your coffee with a cat curled up on your lap? Or sit on a couch and twirl a cat toy while a little calico chased it around? Well, that's a reality now since the Nine Lives Cat Cafe has opened in Fountain Square. Owners Selena Hubbard and her dad Eric seem to have a hit on their hands, as a cat-loving public has embraced their new cat cafe.
I first read years ago about cat cafes in Asia. I believe the first one was in Taiwan. And I read about ones in Japan and South Korea. And I was like, oh, this is the most amazing idea ever. I love coffee. I love cats. Whoever thought of this is just like a genius. And then they weren't in the U.S. at the time, and just the health department regulations would not allow, like, in Japan, you know, the cats are crawling on the counters and things like that, and that would not go over very well here. But whenever they started opening in the U.S., they had made a division with the cats on one side and then coffee on the other side with a wall. So they were in separate rooms, and so then they started popping up all over the U.S. with that same, like, concept of, like, dividing the place in half. And so we're like, okay, cat cafes can happen in the U.S. We need this to happen in Indy. So
now, did you get much pushback? Did people think that was kind of the idea was a little out there?
Yeah, well, it kind of just depends. Like, people are, like, really black and white on it. It's either, oh my gosh, that's the best idea, I love cats, I love coffee, you guys are great, or it's just like, ew, that sounds terrible, I'm not a cat lover, I don't want cat fur in my coffee, it's going to stink. Like, you hear all these different things. So people are either, like, really negative about it, or they're really, really excited. And there's not really a gray area, which is kind of funny.
Now, you're in, opened this with your dad, Eric. So what did you think about the idea when the idea of a cat cafe came up?
Well, I was always receptive to the idea of partnering with her for business. It's something that we had talked about when she was a young teenager. But when she brought up the cats, you know, I'm the boring business part of this partnership, and it was a tough sell for her. I knew that they existed. I wasn't really sure what Indianapolis would think of a cat cafe, and when it became apparent that we were going to be self-funding, then it became even more critical that we have a solid business plan and really have a good idea that we were going to be able to make this. So it was a tough sell for her.
Now, you mentioned self-funded. Is this doesn't strike me as something that a bank is going to say, oh, sure, go ahead and let me give you a loan.
Right. They did not say that. We did speak to a couple of banks. We started to go down a direction of trying to buy a building. We explored options for business loans, small business loans. The banks felt like it was a pretty high risk. I would say there is one bank that was receptive to the idea, but we would have really to put up so much of our assets, our personal assets, to be able to make this happen that it wasn't feasible for us. So
how did you make it work then?
We started a GoFundMe, and that kind of helped, although I would say it really wasn't too successful. We got maybe about almost a tenth of what we originally wanted. So it did help. Yes, thank you for all those people who donated, although it did not pay to open this place. Instead, we basically used my dad's savings to open it. So I'm in debt to him, definitely.
So, because, you know, I can understand, you know, the idea is a little unusual, but it seems to have really taken off. So I think that there must have been some interest out there, some pent-up demand that we didn't know that we had for a cat cafe.
And really, part of what made all this work was the alliances and partnerships that we made with people who were like-minded. So even though we were on this endeavor on our own, we really weren't. Our coffee roaster, for instance, is also helped us. He also helped us do the build out. Our bakers are all local people, small business owners. We couldn't have made it happen without them. So we actually had a pretty big partnership, you know, multi-person, multi-business partnership that was helping us out in various ways. But it was difficult, and it did slow things down.
So now, how did you get going? How does the process work from the idea of thinking, I'm going to have a cat cafe, to actually getting it up and running?
Well, so we had to draw up some business plans, we really kind of had to proof the business concept as much as we could. We had to do a lot of research first to, you know, determine whether it was even feasible to put a cat cafe in Indy. So Selena actually took on a lot of that research, and I'd say probably months worth of research, and you know, came up with what we thought was going to be a good solid plan. And then of course we just kind of went from there and started trying to solidify it into a real business. So
now tell me how it works for people who might not be able to imagine how you can have a coffee shop with the cats and that sort of thing. How does it all work?
Well, basically, one side is just a normal coffee shop. Our space is divided in half. So we have the normal coffee shop on one side, and you can just come in, order coffee, and sit down and work or do whatever you'd like in a normal coffee shop. And then the other half is a room filled with adoptable cats from the Humane Society of Indianapolis. And it's kind of like a living room sort of environment. There's comfy seating in there and tables, and then there's just like a bunch of cat trees and cat toys and cats, of course. And so you can bring your coffee and food in there if you'd like, or you can just sit on the coffee shop side.
And there are windows so that you can watch the cats from the coffee shop side too.
Yep. So even if you don't want to go into the cat side, you can definitely watch the cats play. And a lot of people seem to enjoy that. And so we do 12 people at one time in the cat lounge. That's what we call it. So in the cat lounge, there are 12 people at one time. And we recommend reservations for that just because sometimes it can get full pretty quickly. We do $5 for an hour in there, or $3 for half an hour, and the money helps us to for the upkeep of that room, taking care of the cats, and of course taking care of the employees that work on that side and make sure that everybody's playing safe with the cats and the cats are playing safe with the people.
Now tell me how the cat part of it works. These cats are adoptable, right?
All the cats are from the Humane Society of Indianapolis, and basically, if somebody comes in and sees a cat that they fall in love with, then they can talk to an employee and we'll show them how to apply for the cat. And from there, Indy Humane takes on the rest of the adoption process. So we're basically kind of like a foster home or an off-site free-roaming cat room for them. And then the Humane Society just does the whole adoption process, basically.
So tell me how opening day was, or when you first opened. I would imagine it was a little crazy.
Yeah, it was definitely crazy. We actually started out with a Yelp event, and we had, I think it was like 200 people in just a few hours. So it was definitely really crazy. And the whole rest of the day was just like, it's just a blur now. It was so many people came in just to check us out, which was awesome. And really, ever since then, weekends have been booked. They've been really busy, and evenings have been pretty busy as well. So a lot of people are still coming to check us out.
So they make a reservation and they come in, and then what's it like? What happens?
So basically, whenever you make a reservation, you can check in at the counter at the coffee bar, and we can make you a drink or get you a pastry if you'd like, and then you go into the cat room, and we have you sign a little waiver before you go in, and we have a little bit, or we have a few rules to look over, that's just to make sure that everybody is safe and the cats are, the cats and the people are both safe. And then you can just go chill out over there and have coffee and play with the cats.
So. Now these cats, these are friendly people-friendly cats, and so you really can play with them, pet them, hold them, is that right?
Yeah, they all seem to really like people, which is great. The Humane Society has chosen cats for our location that's, like, they're specifically, like, super friendly cats. They're the ones that they think would do really well over here. They're very social, very playful, and so you can definitely play with them, and some of them you can pick up. We do ask that you ask the employee who's in there, our cat wrangler, which ones are okay with being picked up, but there's a couple we have in there right now that just, like, want to be held like babies. They're so cute.
We've been talking today with Selena Hubbard and her father, Eric, about the Nine Lives Cat Cafe in Fountain Square in Indianapolis. You can check out ninelivesindy.com or look for the cafe on Facebook. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, your host for Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, where we talk local food and drink every week here on WFYI and WFYI.org. And this week, we're talking restaurant history with Katie Harris, owner of Iozzo's Garden of Italy in Indianapolis. Now, her restaurant has been open on South Meridian Street since 2009, but her family's restaurant history goes way back, all the way to the 1930s. Katie takes us back to Prohibition-era Indianapolis when her family ran a huge restaurant on Illinois Street, the original Iozzo's Garden of Italy. She tells us about the restaurant, how you could manage to get a drink in a teacup during Prohibition, about the tragic barroom brawl that ended the family's business, and about how she brought it back to life.
In 1916, my family settled in Indianapolis. My great-grandfather, Santora Iozzo, worked for the railroads and ended up here in Indianapolis. Had a importing-exporting business in Boston before that, and then opened a grocery store here in Indianapolis. Had that from 1920 to 1929. During the Depression, they closed the grocery store, and a year later, they opened a small family dining restaurant called Naples Grill. It's set at 117 and a half North Illinois Street.
This was in 1930, right?
Yes, that's correct. And then a year later, they opened a sister restaurant on North Pennsylvania Street, two blocks away. Everybody back then thought it was a little bit silly that our family had two restaurants. So the cooks had a joke that they should have a conveyor belt moving the meatballs back and forth between the two kitchens. So my great-grandfather said, okay, I understand, we'll combine our efforts and move it to one restaurant. So they opened what was known as Iozzo's Garden of Italy in 1932, set at 32-34-36 South Illinois Street, where the Hyatt Hotel sits.
So this was a big operation.
It was a huge restaurant. Their dining room sat 500 guests, and then they had a banquet room that sat 350. Two kitchens, four bars, dinner and dancing on the weekends. So when you came to dine in Indianapolis in the 1930s, you probably dined at Iozzo's.
Now, this was in the middle of the Depression, so that was even more surprising.
Absolutely. The Depression, the Prohibition, so all sorts of things kind of, like, stacked against them to make this restaurant successful. They used to have false steps leading upstairs where they used to keep casks of whiskey and wine. And if you were a friend of the family, they would give you a Fred Iozzo okay card, and you would lay it down, and in your teacup, they would either bring you whiskey or wine. Because they would know you.
You had an okay card? Oh, my goodness.
Fred Iozzo okay card, yeah. So my sister, she wants us to do an okay card. And I'm like, well, I don't think that we need an okay card now. But everybody's allowed to drink today. So.
But that's wonderful family history. Yeah. But then there's sort of a kind of a tragic ending to that story,
yeah,
isn't it?
Absolutely. During October of 1940, a group of gentlemen come into the restaurant. My grandfather Dominic is tending bar, and his sister Mary is sitting at the end of the bar finishing up her serving shift. These gentlemen begin making passes towards my great-aunt Mary. Well, my grandfather didn't like that too much. So he said, gentlemen, you know, you need to leave. You don't have to go home, but you got to get out of here. Well, they didn't like that too much. They began arguing. Argument led into a fight. Fight basically led into an all-out brawl where they had my grandfather on the ground, basically beating him to death. So at this point in the restaurant, there's all sorts of commotion. People are yelling and screaming. My great-grandfather, Santora, who's in the office, comes out and sees what's going on. He was like, holy, they're going to kill my son. So he goes back into the office and grabs his gun, comes out and shoots the guy. Well, at this point, the gentleman is on top of my grandfather, strangling him. The bullet passes through this gentleman and lands in my grandfather's spleen. So my great-grandfather freaks out, runs, goes, throws the gun in the dumpster, and they call the police, they call the ambulance, and if you weren't taken to the hospital, you were taken down to the police station for questioning. Nobody knows what happened. Everybody had a different story, and it was a crazy night. Well, unfortunately, later in the evening, the gentleman who the bullet passed through, the gentleman that was strangling my grandfather, passed away. So after all this is said and done, the police charged my grandfather and my great-grandfather with murder. While during the discovery process before the trial happened, they dropped the charges against my grandfather, but the charges against my great-grandfather still stood. So, as an Italian-American, in January of 1941, going to trial, in the midst of everything that was going on in Chicago with the mafia, everything that was going on overseas, you know, Indianapolis kind of wanted to make an example. We're not going to stand for this. So, the trial got all this press, and they labeled it the sensational trial of Fred S. Iozzo, and there are daily recaps in the Star and News of what happened.
I mean, this is a huge, huge story.
It was a huge story. And my family kind of did everything to separate themselves from the Italian culture during this troubling time. They even changed the name of the restaurant from Iozzo's Garden to Italy to Iozzo's Cafe later on. Because they just, you know, everybody kind of wanted to disassociate themselves with the country. And so the trial happened. My great-grandfather was eventually convicted, but convicted of involuntary manslaughter. Sentenced to prison. Didn't spend any time behind bars. Became the personal chef of the warden the day he got there.
Oh, my goodness. Really?
Yes. And then was released about 18 months later. There is one of these funny side family stories is that he was denied parole his first time. And we thought maybe it was because the warden didn't want to lose his chef. So he was denied his first parole, but then released about 18 months later. But part of the sentencing was the family was never able to get our liquor tavern license back, so they were never able to reopen the restaurant.
That was part of the punishment?
Mm-hmm. So they had lost their liquor license, and they weren't able to get it. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Now, that really is a tragic end to the story, except that the story didn't really end, right?
No.
So you come more generations down the road, and here you are. So tell me how you got back into this.
So it's a crazy thing. My my degree is not in restaurant hospitality management. It's in corporate finance, but hospitality is kind of in our blood. And we were looking at some spaces at the time to move one of our companies down to this area of Indianapolis, and we were looking at the Ship Optical building, which sits at the northern end of our block. And unfortunately, the building was too small for what we wanted to do with it. But then they were like, hey, there's a little restaurant, pizzeria set up down. Do you guys want to take a walk through? We were like, hey, okay, let's go. So we came in, and, you know, the space was good. You know, it had good bones. It had amazing brick walls and a beautiful archway. I was like, this is really nice. This could be a really cute, like, Italian panini stand. Like, you come in, you get an espresso, you stand up at the bar like you do in Italy, and you eat your lunch, and then you go back to work. And then they told me that there was a courtyard. And I was like, what? So at this point, there was a really cool 1800 style door with the two pocket windows up at top and the old brass handle. So you're trying to get this door open, right? It's creaking. It's a story, right? It's a storybook. And you just kind of open it. And then all of a sudden, there's this literally like brush at your hands where you have to push it back. And then you open it. And it's a secret garden. Style, the cobblestones, and at that time there was a fireplace back there, and I'm like, this is really cute. We could really make this a beautiful Italian restaurant.
Uh-oh, so it was speaking to you even then.
Like my heart started racing, and it just kind of transpired, and just then my brain started like, Katie, we could do this. This could be a really amazing space for a restaurant. We can do it. And I turned around and looked at the rest of the people, and they were like, uh-oh. She's got it in her eyes. We're going to get, we're opening a restaurant. So that was March 23rd. By April, I think, 7th or 8th, I was in my lawyer's office signing LLC paperwork. April 14th, we were at an auction. And by August 3rd, 2009, we were open.
Oh, my goodness. So 2009. Wow.
Yes. And I remember Mary Mills came in the very first day we opened. And she goes, what are you doing opening a restaurant in the middle of this recession? I'm like, I got lots of friends and family who love to eat spaghetti. It's like, I don't know. It's
so did it ever occur to you that it was a bad time or that it wouldn't work or any of that?
Not really. I mean, it's just one of those things that when you set your mind to something, you're going to figure out how to get it done and we're going to make it happen. So, that was all in 2009. It was a crazy summer. We actually went to Italy. We still have family that lives there. So we went and visited them. And my mom was like, let's just make sure this pasta sauce is absolutely correct. So we went there. And, of course, it was. Like, the meatballs, the spaghetti, the sauce was exactly the same that we had been eating for years and years here. So that was good. And then, you know, just kind of the whole process. And my grandmother was still alive at the time. And I go, Grandma, you know, when we get into this, are you okay with me reopening Iozzo's? And she goes, well, Katie, do you have to tell the story? And I go, Grandma, if we don't, somebody else will.
We've been talking with Katie Harris of Iozzo's Garden of Italy, located on South Meridian Street in Indianapolis. For more information on the restaurant, go to iozzos.com or look for it on Facebook. It's October now, the leaves are falling, and even though we're still waiting for some crisp fall weather, you know it's probably just around the corner. And that means the summer farmers market season is coming to an end. But these days, many of our local markets continue year-round. One such market is the Farm to Fork Market at Normandy Farm, a chemical-free producer-only market that operates at 7802 Marsh Road on Indy's northwest side. I talked last fall with Market Master Maria Smetana about what makes her market special.
The market has been running for 3 years now. We're going into our fourth season. We started in spring of 2013. A couple of things make it unique. To the best of our knowledge, it is still Indiana's only farmers market that requires all the vendors to be using organic practices in everything that they grow or produce. We have both farmers and food artisans at the market. We also require that what is sold is produced by the person selling it. So we are not a reseller market. The farmers sell or make what they grow. And finally, everything is grown in Indiana, which is our definition of local. Other farmers markets have other definitions, but all of our vendors have always been from within Indiana.
So now tell me a little bit about why you started the market and how it was to launch that type of market, that specific sort of market.
Mm-hmm. We owe a debt of gratitude to Traders Point Creamery, where many of us were vendors before this market started. And we wanted to take it into a direction of being completely in line with the National Organics Program. So we started the new market on the grounds of Normandy Farm.
Now, where is that?
It is located at 7802 Marsh Road, which is at the corner of Marsh Road and 79th Street. And that is historically known as the old Krennet Farm or Normandy Farm. It was at one point a working farm, and some of the farm buildings and the fields have been preserved as the suburbs have grown up around it. It's a very beautiful property with old trees, and it's been a great place to call home for our market.
Now, it's indoors for winter, right?
It is. We either use the existing buildings on the farm. This year, we purchased a heated trailer where all of us are packed in and cozy. So yes, the market does operate year round. In summer, we just park out in the meadow, and in winter, we are inside where it's warm and dry.
Now, tell me what sort of vendors you have there, and the process you go through to make sure those vendors are meeting your standards.
All of the vendors are either small family farmers or small food artisans. Some are both. They are operations that grow produce, meat, eggs, or all of the above. Increasingly, our vendors are diversifying into as many products as they can grow to make ends meet. Same with our artisan food producers. Some start with one or two key products that make money for them and then branch out into more types of artisan food. The process starts with a very long application, an interview, and then I visit the farm to get an idea of whether what I see on the farm seems to jive with what they've said on their application.
Now, what are you looking for when you do a farm visit?
I'm looking for what is typically found on a small organic family farm. I look for things like feed bags, fertilizer bags. I actually ask them to show me what they're feeding their chickens, for instance, to make sure that it meets the National Organic Program standards. Fertilizer bags. Often I will ask for receipts, especially from vendors who are food artisans, to make sure that what they are purchasing, what the ingredients they are purchasing to go into the food product, is indeed certified organic or coming from a source that follows the National Organic Program standards. So it's a strict process before the vendor even gets through the door.
Now, that does seem very strict. Now, tell me why. You know, why go to this much trouble and, you know, not go the route of, well, someone wants to be in, here you go, sure, here's a table and set up.
I think as we get more farmers markets in the Indianapolis area, you need to differentiate yourself. So that's the first important thing. And secondly, it all comes down to customer demand. We have our customer base are people who believe in organic food, and they are really, truly desperate for a place where they can shop for chemical-free food without having to ask questions. They know that I keep the market standards high, and that if there is ever a question about a vendor's integrity or honesty, that I will follow up to make sure that organic standards are being followed.
So I, as a shopper, don't have to quiz every vendor about, well, how was this raised? What do you feed your animals? What kind of ingredients you use? You've done all that.
Exactly. We're Midwesterners. We don't like to be confrontational. And I've heard from many, many customers that when they go to other farmers markets, they sometimes feel like they're put in a position of having to ask each vendor how they raise their farm products or make their artisan food. And it's very uncomfortable for them. So when they come to this market, they know they don't have to ask a question, or if they do have a question, they know that they won't be met with a defensive response. I am more than happy to have customers question either myself or any of my vendors. And if there is ever a concern, I will follow up on that concern personally to make sure that the customer's fears are taken care of.
Now, as to who is raising the products, you know, that's part of your questioning too, you know, so that it's a producer only market.
That is correct. So we not only enforce that every vendor is working under the standards of the National Organics Program, but every vendor must make or grow what they sell. So there's no reselling, there's no third-party selling, there's no buying from auctions or produce stocks.
Now, that sort of thing, I understand, takes place more often than people might imagine, you know, when they're just going to a regular farmer's market.
Yeah, not to pick on other farmers markets, certainly. However, unless the market enforces standards, there are situations, and some farmers markets are, actively state in their policy that vendors are allowed to sell a certain amount of food that is purchased from other farms or from auctions or that comes from out of state. The other aspect to our market is that everything is grown within Indiana. Every vendor and every farmer comes from within Indiana, which makes it very easy for me to go and see the farm and make sure they are complying with the standards because I don't have to drive far. But yeah, each farmer's market has its own rules. Some allow just about anything. Others have some restrictions on reselling or where the food comes from. It's always good if the consumer cares, if it makes a difference to them, it does not hurt to ask. I always tell consumers that they should ask if they have a question about where their food comes from. It's their right to know. They should never feel intimidated. And if a vendor does respond in a defensive fashion to their questions, or if the market master responds in a less than open fashion, they may reconsider whether they want to keep supporting that market.
We've been talking with Maria Smetana, Market Master at the Farm to Fork Market at Normandy Farm in Indianapolis. For more information on the market, check out farmtoforkmarket.org. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and thanks also to our guests. Gwendolyn Rogers of the Cake Bake Shop, Elizabeth Garber of the Best Chocolate in Town, Selena Hubbard and Eric Hubbard of Nine Lives Cat Cafe, Katie Harris of Iozzo's Garden of Italy, and Maria Smetana of the Farm to Fork Market at Normandy Farm. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio.